Yeah. 1212. Welcome to the show, everyone. Another episode of American Riddle. This is your boy, Malcolm Riddle. I got in studio today, I got my man from back in the day, Rico Phillips from Flint, Michigan. So we're going to, you guys have heard me talk about, I've given you bits and pieces of my past growing up in Flint, Michigan. And you've seen and heard stories about Flint, Michigan, you know, on the internet, online, and in the news. But we're going to bring it to you the way it's supposed to be brought. So straight from my main man, Rico, who's living it. You know, he ain't got no reason to lie. So here's my man, Rico Phillips, straight out of Flint. What up, Rico?
Hey, I'm happy to be here today. How about you, Malc?
Doing what I does, you know me.
Yeah, for sure. You are always doing something, man.
making moves.
You know? Yeah, might as well. You can't be letting yourself sit still.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I appreciate you agreeing to be on the show. It's good to catch up, too, you know what I mean, because we haven't talked in a while.
Right, I know it. I think it was a few years ago when you visited and you had your son with you.
Yeah.
Man, how old was he then, about five?
I could pick him up and put him on my lap. Now if I put him on my lap, it's a little weird.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, he's 12 now, so yeah, he's you know, he can fit into my hoodies.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I believe it.
Which is really weird, but you know, he's a big guy. I need to make a trip back up there. I've been kind of scared to come up there with the weather the way it's been. I mean, it's been cold up there.
Oh yeah, it's cold outside right now. I mean, we're getting ready to hit one of this polar vortex. I've never heard that term until 2014, but okay, here we go. Yeah. But yeah, it's chilly. We just call it Arctic blast is what we used to call it, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot of terms today that they, you know, we didn't use them 20, 30 years ago. You know what I mean? Yeah. They just didn't exist.
Yeah, they called it Canadian air is what they called it when we were young, you know. Came right out of Canada. Freeze your ass off.
Still had to go to school.
Yeah, oh, man, I'm telling you right now, they cancel school on a regular basis because of the wind chill is dangerous. I'm like, what? I don't remember these. I remember one day walking to school, and it was so cold that that's when I realized I had asthma. I got to school and couldn't breathe, and my mom had to come get me and take me to the doctor. I mean, that's how cold it was. It took my breath away.
Yeah, it's now, you know, I think kids today have just gotten a little soft.
Yeah.
I mean, they got comfortable, they got soft, they got the video games, the movies, everything in your house.
And, right.
You know, why leave?
Right, exactly. You know? It comfortable for everybody,
I guess. You can even take classes at home.
Yeah, that's true. You're doggone right.
I would have never done that. Plus, my grandfather would have never allowed something like that.
Right. I remember my mother routinely and all of our parents routinely get out of the house, go outside, go. And I try that with my kids and they go outside and look in like a puppy, you know, what are we doing going to do now? It's one of those things, man. Time has changed, no doubt.
You know what I mean? I always tell my son, go out and throw a brick. You know what I mean? Throw a rock at something. I don't care what you do. Get the hell up out of here.
Yeah. Remember we used to throw dirt bombs. Remember dirt bombs?
Yeah. I haven't seen a good old dirt bomb fight. Decades, I think.
I know that's right.
I'm sure there's some kids out there that's having them, but not in my hood.
Right, mine either.
I haven't seen them, but yeah. Back to Flint, Michigan. So, I guess we can start from the beginning. You know what I mean? I reminisce a lot on this podcast, just about the glory days of the 80s. You know what I mean? I'm one of those dudes. Back in the 80s.
Right. Yeah.
But the 80s was the shit, because that's the foundation of everything, not everything, but it's a big part of what's going on today, especially when you see hip hop, the way hip hop has pretty much evolved, and it's worldwide. So when I see that and I remember the early stages of hip hop and its roots where we were, I mean, we were right in the mix of it.
There's no doubt about it. In fact, it's intriguing because I have a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old sons, and I have a 12-year-old daughter or 13-year-old daughter also. But my older boy in particular, he's really into hip hop right now. And what's cool about him is he's kind of tried to learn a little bit about the roots of hip hop. And I told him, you know, obviously we're from the 80s. No, it wasn't called hip hop. It was rap music, you know. And I remember the very first 12-inch record I ever owned was Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. And I must have played that over and over and over. But it was just so different and almost refreshing. Like there was something catchy about it that you could grip onto. The problem that I seen that I didn't realize was happening then was that rap was built a lot on racial lines. I mean, it was a number of years before it crossed over. And so it was kind of like our music, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. I tell people all the time that there was a time when it wasn't cool to be black. You know what I mean?
Right,
It wasn't cool to be, you know, associated with rap music. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was frowned upon like it was gibberish or something, you know, like people, you know, these are ignorant people, and didn't realize that there was a lot of content to what these rappers were putting in their lyrics, you know, but they just didn't give it the time of day. Interesting, talking about the 80s, I remember there was a party at my house. I hate to even bring that up because I got in some trouble over that party. But I remember that I had my friends from the neighborhood, which included you, and my friends, my newfound friends from high school that actually I got on board with the hockey team. And we were battling all night over what music we were going to listen to. We went from Stairway to Heaven to Rock the Bells. I couldn't tell you how many times where I just was like, man, can we just agree on one music? And nobody could. We couldn't agree all night on what we were going to listen to. But it was still, you know, for us, it was the beginning of stuff I couldn't even imagine to where we're at today as far as hip hop's concerned.
Yeah, it's funny that you say it because back in those days, either you're playing a tape or a record, and when you're at a party, you know what I mean? Usually you didn't have a playlist, like an iPod that you could play.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's a variety, or it would shuffle. It just didn't work that way unless you had a DJ and he was up there spinning.
But, right.
You know, outside of that, yeah, what you picked is what you picked, and that's what you listened to.
Right.
Until it was time to turn the tape or the record over.
Right, exactly.
I mean, that was it.
Oh, man. It was insane. We thought we were somebody, though, didn't we?
I kind of knew back then that it was frustrating for me back then just because I knew that I felt anyway in my heart that it was the beginning of something great. And I knew we were limited by, at that time, we were, and still are in a lot of ways, but limited because of finances. You know, you needed you needed huge amounts of money to get studio time back then.
Right.
You know what I mean? I've said this on a podcast before. For us to do what we're doing right now, we would be gods in our community.
You know right, I mean? definitely.
They would put us up in the air and walk with us if we had these microphones and the mixer that I have and, you know, an iPad. If you had an iPad, you might as well had fire amongst cavemen.
Right, no doubt about it. I remember when computers first came out and I was trying to learn DOS and I had no clue. We were happy when we could print something out on that big printer with them lines on the side that made a design or happy birthday or something. You know, I mean, really elementary. Man, look at that. Take it home and tape it up on your wall like you were somebody. I'm a computer whiz. Little did we know what we have in front of us. I mean, just clicks away from any information we could imagine, more than we probably need, to be honest with you. But that's my spin.
Yeah, and you know but it was still a very magical period because you know, it was the birth of everything that we know now. And even now, when I think about today, I think I look at where we're at. It's still evolving. It's just evolving at a much faster rate.
Right, absolutely. I agree with you totally.
And, you know, I remember, just being in awe because Flint, the music scene in Flint, you know, hip hop was, you know, we had it. We had a lot of MCs. We had a lot of break dancing. you go to school and, school was broken down. Of course, you had the jocks, nerds, you had all these different groups, and you had the B-boys, You know what I mean? Yeah. And the MCs, which is where I kind of found my sanctuary. And, yeah, we would just post up on the wall and assume the position. Don't crack a smile. You remember that shit?
Yeah, I do remember that. Back hallway, man. No kidding, man. We were somebody.
Yeah, you would assume the position, whatever stance that was. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
You would assume that position and hold it. And be like, I remember dudes would hit you in that side. Don't crack a smile. No matter what. You know, because in Flint, if you smiled, that was weakness.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I felt it in even middle school. I went to a middle school that was really diverse in the sense that there was kids that was they were straight up from the hood. And then there was these West Side kids from the Upper West Side, we'll call it. And they coexisted pretty well, but it was intimidating from time to time. I know people weren't probably as happy with the busing situation, but, man, I tell you what, it sure didn't make us who we are today.
Yeah, it was challenging for me, to say the least, because I spent elementary school in Flint, and then we moved away and moved around the country, Denver, California, Texas, and just made a full circle. I came back to Flint right there in the 80s, and I went from, you know, kind of like a life of Carlton from The Fresh Prince, right back in the mix of things in Flint. You know what I mean? And it was that's when I moved in with my grandparents.
Yeah.
And oh my God, man, the school system. I mean, it was eye opening, to say the least. Like you said, it was a breakdown of all different types of group. And Flint Southwestern is where I went, where we went. It wasn't known as the roughest school by far.
No, I would agree.
Kind of like kind of middle of the road, I guess. You know what I mean? It was some people from all walks of life and blue collar. You know?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think all of our parents, or a majority of our parents, worked. Had something to do with the industry here, which is auto factories. But you know, we had a connection or a tie of some sort to it.
Yeah, straight blue collar. My grandmother, of course, she retired from GM, and a lot of my buddies, you know, their parents were working for GM and getting laid off at that time, and going back to work and then getting laid off. I mean, it was a cycle of ups and downs in that period, and you could feel it. Like, you could feel the tension.
Right. Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I can remember a few fights at school, and they were the premise was just basically race relations and the lack thereof, you know, that sometimes it just boiled over for no apparent reason either. I mean, it wasn't like I felt tension in the school that I went to, because like you said, it was a melting pot. But from time to time, you'd have things because the polarity of our town still does exist now, but it was there then,
yeah.
You know, and it would cause the situation where you know, everybody didn't get along based on race. And it's kind of crazy, though, because this is Flint. And as hardcore as we are, we all love this place. You know, we're kind of brought back here, you know, like a magnet almost.
Yeah, yeah. If you have to get that, it's all right. Don't worry.
No, we're good.
The show goes on. The right. Yeah, it's a it was a time that, that you could feel the tension. And the tension came from all over the place. All, you know, it could be because you had, you know, your home life, your parents may be getting laid off, there may be a pressure finding a job or keeping a job, or just the you know, the pressure of living in the inner city and you know, existing and surviving day to day. I mean, people read about Flint and they write about Flint, but I don't think they know Flint. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. I think we didn't realize it maybe so much in the 80s that we were at the brink of the bottom falling out, so to speak. I mean, I got hired in by the city in 1992, and things were still pretty good here. I mean, you started to see a decline where jobs were starting to be moved around, but there was a lot of tension between the union, UAW, and GM. And one of the big problems that Flint faced that we didn't realize was going to crush us is that all of our industry was in one basket. In other words, all we really did here was make cars. We didn't do much else. So when that happened, basically when the jobs left, so did the people that were providing for tax base, for providing for you know, quality families in our schools, they all started to leave. And when that happens, then, of course, things become abandoned and vacant and businesses shut down. So those places become abandoned, vacant. And you start to have, I don't think the leaders at the time of all this recognized what was going on and figured out a way before it was too late to try to attract, you know, industry here other than making cars. So with all that said, Malk, now what you got left is a broken down town, and it's not the folks that are here, you know, it's not their fault. They're byproducts of the manufacturing industry that we had here. But they're the ones that are left that didn't have the resources maybe, or maybe got to the point of their age where it wasn't going to do them any good to leave anyways. There's nowhere to go. I mean, no one's going to buy your house for nowhere near what you think it's worth. So, and then the bad part is the crumbling of our education because of it, where you have lots of single parent families, and it's nothing against single parents. I'm just saying that they don't, a lot of the parents, or excuse me, the students that are existing in our local schools, don't have a great support at home. They don't have good role models at home. And so it's just, I'm hoping we're at the bottom, Mal, because like you said, people read about us. They maybe talk about us, maybe heard of us, but to get deep down into what happened and how to get back to where it should be, I don't know. It's hard to say.
And you say, when you said that you hired in, what exactly have you been doing and what do you do in Flint?
Oh. I'm a firefighter, professional firefighter in the city of Flint, where we work, you know, 24-hour shifts with 48 hours off in between. So in that span of time, I've watched and seen, you know, I get a different bird's eye view of the citizens and the residents and the people that come through Flint, because obviously I'm there at the crisis or sometimes the worst day of their life, and I'm the person that's got to come see them. And as a result of working for the local government, which is what we work for, then I also get a rare opportunity to see the crumbling of our inner city from a whole different perspective, because I'm an employee and we feel it first. When the city starts to fold up, you know, they go after our wages and benefits, because for some reason we're stealing that from the folks. So we're stealing that from the government, which isn't the case, obviously, but that's how they make us feel.
Yeah, that's got to be frustrating.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, because I've been there since 92, so 21 years ago when I started, it was a whole different place. Flint was a different place, and the department was different. They treated the employees with a little bit more dignity and respect in the fact that we were the first responders of our city. But unfortunately, like I said, with the breakdown of people flocking away from Flint to go to better horizons, then you don't have the tax base that pays our salaries. And our salaries, police and firefighters in particular, are a large portion of the budget for any city government. And that's why you see so many smaller departments or on-call fire departments, because they don't have to pay their personnel as much. But what you also have in a town that's broken down is large volumes of vacant house fires and large volumes of traumatic situations, you know, stabbings, shootings, those types of things that are, you have to have a full-time fire department to respond. You'd never be able to do it with on-call guys. So with that said, we're still here, but they're running out of money to pay for us. So the only way to do that is to take away the things that we worked really hard for all these years. And now that I'm at the end of my career, Mal, who'd figure? We're almost bankrupt, you know? So here we go. What's next? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's I've read over the years where they've cut the budget for firefighters and police. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically, when you do that, it's worse than the Wild West. I mean, it's just anarchy in the streets, because anything goes, and it can, with that frustration, when you pull, and I've used this analogy before, if you rip the heart out of someone, you can't expect that person to perform, you know, the way they did before. And that's what happened with Flint. That's what happened with Detroit. You know, when the heart is, when you perform major surgery, a surgical procedure on someone, and expect that person, you know, to go out and perform at peak level, it's not going to happen. You know, it's just, it ain't going to happen. So you start to see it crumble. You start to see, you know, the the erosion of Flint and Detroit. And this is what people are seeing. And all people do is, you know, I guess you're just looking on the outside and shaking your head. You know what I mean? I don't see a lot of people coming to the aid of the places like Flint and Detroit. And I always say there are lots of examples of Flint and Detroit around the country.
Yeah. Yeah. And there certainly are. You know, I think you made a perfect analogy. I was just thinking about how you put it. It's like the guts are ripped out of our town. All that's left is a skeleton.
Yeah.
And I know that there's other cities. It's hard to cry boo-hoo. Certainly our world is focused here. When there's other places that have gone through that are currently going through the exact same thing. But I will say this, Grand Rapids, also in our state, went through something very similar to what Flint was going through, oh, I'd say about 15 years ago or maybe a little bit more. But the big thing, there was a lot of differences in the fact that the west side of the state of Michigan is different than mid-Michigan or even the eastern side of the state. It's much more conservative and Republican-based, and so they tend to vote differently and do things differently. But by the same token, that side of the state, because of the way it's where it's located in our state, is a very beautiful side of the state. So a lot of tourism is there. So there's money flowing in there. And what was happening with Grand Rapids is they were starting to have this major decline because of General Motors. But the difference, again, was the folks that were from over there that were wealthy decided to pour money into Grand Rapids before its destruction. And the one thing that they were able to do was secure industry outside of auto manufacturing. There still are a lot of manufacturing over there, but it's there's FlexSteel, which is a office furniture company. There's several different types of manufacturing, types of different manufacturers over there, as well as the tourism industry. And so as I went through their town a couple of years ago, Malcolm, this is what kind of blew me away, because this is a town that's about twice the size of Flint. And so I'm expecting, I was there for my son's hockey tournament, and we were there in the summer. It's a rare summer tournament. And I walked in, and one of the hockey parents said to me, "Man, I didn't know we had to go to the hood to get here." And I kind of thought to myself, you know, I drove in, I didn't see no hood.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe they went from a different direction. So then I walked over, and I was talking to another parent, and a whole different parent said the exact same thing. "Man, we had to go through the hood to get here, though, huh?" And I'm thinking, what the hell did they see that I didn't see? So I purposely, Malcolm, went the opposite direction of the way I came in, and I'm looking for the hood.
Yeah.
And while I did see a apartment tenement style building, what I seen was kids playing. I didn't see a bunch of adults hanging around, maybe some grandmas out there and people like that. But it wasn't like I've seen here in Flint, I'll put it that way, where people, young adults are just hanging out with nothing to do look on their faces, you know. And so I went literally for 25 blocks in each direction, and I did not find one vacant house, one boarded up house. And it blew my mind, because I can't go anywhere inside of our town without seeing something boarded up and vacant. And so it's all about quality of life. And I think that Flint has got to, and cities like Flint have to break down almost to nothing and start over from scratch and figure out what their new identity is. And unfortunately, I don't think it's happened just yet, but it's starting to happen. Downtown's changing quite a bit.
Yeah, it's amazing to see and hear and witness other people's perception of what they call the hood.
Absolutely.
I mean, it could be based race related. It could be based on, yeah, like you said, condemned buildings or housing or you know, just people hanging out. I mean, it's funny when you see that, because you know, if you get a real dose of what the hood is, you know, a lot of people don't even know how good that they have it. You know?
Right. Right.
You know, because I remember growing up in different parts of Flint. You know, some of them were nicknamed Lebanon. Some
right.
of them were nicknamed Beirut.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of spots. There were certain hoods I didn't even go through. I remember back in the day. You know, we would go out. There was a time, if you want to talk hood, that when we would go out on dates, we would take girls out. We wouldn't go one-on-one with the girl. We would bring a crew.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because you just didn't know what was going to pop off. You had no idea. I mean, we can laugh at it now, but I mean, think about it, man.
Yeah. Because, and you know what's even worse about today compared to then is we actually had places we could go. I remember going to certain dances that were a weekly affair. They don't even have stuff like that anymore, you know what I mean, for young people because of the level of security that you have to bring to them now. I mean, everything's changed. Young people are carrying guns. They're not carrying their fists no more, you know, and that's not just Flint. That's practically anywhere from, you know, just looking at the news, I'm assuming it's like that everywhere. But, man, I mean, like you said, it's about perspective. Back then, we were like, yeah, we're from the hood. We're street smart. But we were smart enough to know that we had it pretty good. So let's just keep ourselves out of those areas. We ain't got nothing to prove by going to certain areas of Flint. What are we going to ride through there for?
Yeah,
ain't our hood.
Yeah. You knew. You just kind of know, you know. Even if you go, you don't go alone. And even if you go with a crew, you're not going with the intent to harm.
Right.
You know, when we would crew up, like someone would see us. And basically, you know, we were just b-boying. We were just hanging out. We'd go to we go to a club or a dance or whatever, and or go to someone's basement and just to, you know, lay down some wax and some tracks. But it was more just because you just don't travel alone because you don't know what's gonna happen, and you don't want anything to happen. And if something does happen, you got a crew. That's the math. It doesn't make it right or wrong. It's just, you know, you want to get back home at the end of the
right.
day.
Right.
You really do. I mean, it's just it's amazing when I look back just for the fact that today you don't even let your kid walk to the corner store.
Right.
And there isn't any more corner stores, but you know, there's certain things you don't do today. The children don't have, they have a lot of freedom, but there's certain things they don't do. Like you said, it's made us who we are, you know, today. And, you know, when people look at, when they say, oh, I didn't know I have to drive through the hood, man, you try walking through the hood.
Right.
You try walking through the hood, you know, even as a black man, a black person, you know, we caught hell because we weren't, you know, quote unquote, black enough. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, exactly. I constantly had to deal with that. That's funny because it's all about, you know, who you are and where you come from. People, I have a different type of vernacular. You know, I don't sound like I'm from the hood. But when I'm at work, you know, I like hockey. I have other interests that maybe not the person from the hood would have even thought that he'd be a part of someday. But my point is that it's interesting when you let a person know where you actually grew up and they're like, wow, you know, you tell them some of the stories of growing up, you know, basically in downtown Flint. They're kind of amazed almost, like it's unbelievable. You made it out. You know, they don't understand. No, it wasn't like that. I mean, we all had good parenting and we had a good foundation. We knew that we wanted to do something in life. We weren't just going to sit there. And yeah. I mean, you know, I have the street smarts I have, the things that set me up for my career was because of where I grew up. And so I have no regrets whatsoever.
You were the only black person in the hood that liked hockey.
Yeah, I still am. And that just kind of came on a whim, to be honest with you, Malcolm. I was a student trainer in high school. And when basketball season came around, the head trainer, Joel Harris, he told me, he said, man, I don't need you to sit down here with me. And some guys that were in one of my classes on the hockey team said, hey, we need a guy. So I asked the coach and I went to a few practices and then I went to my first game and I said, holy shit, man, this looks like fun. And that's what basically changed my whole perspective on a lot of things. I mean, I've been skating since high school, which is really late in life compared to a lot of my opponents that I skate with even today. But I've been able to referee for the sport for 27 years and been able to make lots and lots of friends through it. And what's really cool is my son, who's 15 now, I introduced him to the sport when he was young, but he's refereeing too. So I'm helping him try to decide about work ethic, and it's a great tool for him, you know, learn about being in charge of his destiny sometimes when you're refereeing, man. You're the only buddy you got is your partner, and sometimes he'll sell you out, you know. So, yeah. And you know how crazy parents are. I don't care for what sport it is. They're crazy. So,
yeah, it is. It's a tough and brutal sport, and it's, you know, based on conditioning and strength.
Yeah.
And positioning, you know, it's, I never understood why you were into it, but
my dad either.
Yeah. You were headstrong about it. We never busted your chops that much. I don't think so.
No, not enough. Probably. Yeah. Considered how I've been busted since then. I got fake teeth and my eyes have been damaged come from the damn sport. My father, when I told him I wanted to play, hockey, he says, boy, it made no damn sense. I had this basketball hoop in the backyard since you were 7. That's all you wanted then. You're the only kid in the neighborhood with a hoop, and you got to play hockey?
Yeah.
He says, what's wrong with you, man? So whenever I get hurt, I don't even tell him. I'm hurt because he used to get mad at me. You don't get hurt like that playing basketball.
it is a tough sport, and, you know, it's something that you have to, it's a lifestyle. I mean, it really is. I mean, as with any sport, in our hood, I don't even remember us playing like field hockey. Like we would play football, you know,
right,
on the pavement.
And then
if you went on the grass, we could stick you. That was the rule. But, it was either basketball or football. And I followed you, you know, online over the years, and I'm like, this motherfucker's off his rocker. He's still doing it. There's no way. I mean, I don't play football. I refuse to even play around with that stuff. Are you kidding?
Well, I know. And, you know, I'm getting to that point now, Malcolm, where I'm going, whoa, you know, I've been doing it long. My body's, I'm not a big guy at all. So my body takes punishment a little easier because of it. And
it's harder to recoup.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I broke my leg really bad. A guy checked me, you know, in a men's league game. There's no checking in it, and twisted my leg till it snapped, you know. And I can't believe I came back either from that one. But, you know, something like you said, it's a lifestyle. And one of the things that makes that sport, you know, I know we've gotten way off subject, but what makes the sport different is this level of skill that's involved. Not only do you have to push a puck around and get through all these people, but you got to do it while you're skating, which if you know anything about ice skating, it's not the easiest skill to perfect. So I guess that's one of the reasons I took off on it and got, like you said, headstrong, is because I felt like, you know, this was something that I was going to come outside my own box. I didn't even like the winter coming up as a kid. And I decided that I was going to make the best of winter. And that was how I, you know, we had a ice rink in our neighborhood. We never used or never went over there to Memorial Park, and we never went there. There was an ice rink right there.
Yeah, I can't skate. I made the mistake years ago. I was seeing a young lady and went out, met the parents and all that stuff, and we decided to go ice skating. They wanted to go ice skating. I've never been ice skating before. So I said, well, I've been roller skating. How hard could it be?
Right.
So me trying to be cool. I started lacing them up. I'm like, no big deal. I mean, how hard can it be? Man, I might as well had my ankles might as well have been made of cotton. You know, I've never been so humiliated. I got the shaking and jerking around.
I'm trying to look cool while you're doing that. It ain't easy.
You know, one of the things I learned is no pimping on the ice rink. You know, what I mean, you can't look cool doing it. It's impossible. Impossible. And I tried, but at the end of the day, I was sore. And I was a broken man. And the reason why I wanted to go into hockey is because, are there any sports or outlets for kids today? You mentioned that you know, the kids today are carrying more guns and there's more violence and stuff like that. And with that, you know, with the lack of manufacturing jobs or just jobs itself in the area. You know, there may not be community centers to keep people busy. I know when we were coming up and we talked about this in the beginning of the podcast, we were talking about music, and music was my sanctuary. I mean, that's all I did. I would spin records. I would DJ. We would all get together. And that, I believe in my heart, that kept us grounded in our neighborhood, in and around our neighborhood and the people that we hung out with. But today, I wonder if that, you know, I mean, Detroit itself was Motown, you know
right,
what I mean?
Right, absolutely.
I mean, music was made there, and as with the auto industry, but with all that gone, what outlets are available in Flint, Michigan?
Well, that's an excellent question. The problem is the answer, and the reason I say that is because equally an equal partner in all of the tax base and those things is the school system. And when the government starts to lose money because of tax base, so do the schools. Not only did they lose tax base, they also lost students, which means that obviously each pupil, you know, is worth a certain amount of money to a school system. So then there's cuts. And unfortunately, they're at bare minimum. I mean, they're actually getting ready to take on more cuts. They're getting ready to put 42 students to one teacher in Flint schools. That's an ungodly amount of students. When you're trying to say that you're going to give those kids, each and every one of them, undivided attention if they need it and be able to be productive each and every day when you teach. So with that said, the programs that supported things that we did, we had intramural sports. I mean, we played every sport, whether it was kickball, flag football, softball, turned it to baseball when we got to middle school, and on and on and on. I mean, I remember playing every sport, whether I could actually play the sport or not. I was on the team year round. And it wasn't because my parents made me or thought I was going to be a pro. It's because that's what you did. In order to get exercise, to be with your friends, because all your friends were doing it. You know what I mean? Now they have splinter groups that try to put programs together that have to get funding to make it all happen. It is nothing subsidized. I mean, it's all subsidized by private donations and private charity work to make it happen. It's ironic you ask me about that, Malcolm, because I'm working on a project and I was a part of it a few years ago, back in, I think it was 2010, where I decided that the sport of hockey, while we were not exposed to it in the sense that you and I went out and played it, when I was in school, there was always someone in our school that had a jacket on that played hockey. So that's, to me, a level of exposure. I knew the sport was there and it was available to me if I wanted to play it. There was also floor hockey that kind of introduced you to it when we were younger. Where today there is no floor hockey being played in the inner city schools, and certainly there's no hockey players left in the inner city schools. So I put together a program where I introduced, I don't want to take full, it was a concept I came up with that I decided I wanted to run with, and we provided with some local sponsors 52 kids, I think we put through an inner city youth hockey program where all these kids, the only way you could get in is if you were lived in the city and you didn't play hockey, which obviously if you lived in the city, you weren't playing hockey. So the purpose was just to expose them to the sport. So what we did is we put each one of those kids in full hockey gear from the skates to the helmet. And then we took them out on the ice, and in an 8-week session, we actually taught them how to skate. And by the time it was over, they actually got to play a game. Now, I knew coming out of it that the chances of any of these kids staying with the sport were going to be slim and none. We did have one that did out of the 32 that completed the whole 8 weeks. But the look on the faces of the players was incredible. You could tell by the way they put the equipment on, they had no clue what goes on inside Pirani Arena, which is their old IMA arena. If you're from the old school, except the circus. That's all they know that happens in there, the circus, you know. But now they're out there skating. And unfortunately, the injury I told you about where I broke my leg happened right in the middle of it. And I was so scared to show up with a broken leg because I didn't want these kids to think that's what happens when you play hockey, you know. But we got them through the program. And the final day, the kids were actually playing the game against each other. And the parents were cheering like they'd been a part of the sport forever. And if I could have put a big arm around that day, I wanted to hug it and keep it forever because that's how much it meant to me. What was really cool, Mal, because I teach fire safety in the schools and I go to schools all the time. And I was walking down the hallway of the school called Carpenter Road Elementary. And that school is in the hood, projects all around. You talk about Little Beirut. It's near Little Beirut. And so anyways, I'm walking down the hallway and these two boys are walking towards me. I'm going to a classroom. They're just in the hallway walking. And then the one kid stops. Hey, coach, am looking at this kid. Now, I know all the black kids I've ever coached. The only one I got that comes close is my son. Yeah. So I'm looking at him like, coach, has he got me confused? He said, yeah. And then he said, what do you mean he's your coach? He said, he coaches me in hockey. And that's when it dawned on me what he was talking about. He said, and the other kid said, you play hockey? He said, yeah, I play hockey, don't I, coach? And I looked at that kid, and his head and his chest was swollen up, man. He was so proud of himself. Yeah. I said, heck yeah, you play hockey. You're a good hockey player. Didn't you score a goal? He said, yeah. And I said, yeah, I remember it just like it was yesterday. Good job, man. Good seeing you. And, man, that dude was strutting down the hallway. And right now I'm telling you a story, Malcolm, and I get chills down my spine because I realized that I exposed this kid and opened his mind and his horizon to an area he'd never even imagined. Yeah, and thanks to his parents, he was actually able to show up, you know, and experience it. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, you touched him. You got somewhere and you connected. I mean, that's huge.
And so what we're trying to do, in fact, the program kind of went flat on me. I did it all by myself, and that's where one of the regrets I have is I didn't organize better. But so many people heard so many good things about it that I've had the local Boys and Girls Club and the local United Way contact me, and I've got a meeting coming up at the end of the month, and we're going to try to reinvent the program and provide it because I come to find out there's a soccer organization that's just like ours, and then there's the Flint Pal League that does some of the similar things, but it's all off-site, off-location, so these families actually have to seek these programs out and have to be taken to them, so it's not working out in those respects, but in other respects it is because at least there's folks out here who say, hey, there's a significant need, and they're in our age group because we experienced what we did in the 80s and 70s, and luckily, you know, there's a few of us that care enough to make it happen for a few kids out there.
And what was the name of your program?
Well, it was called the Flint Inner City Youth Hockey Program. I don't know that's going to remain at that name because we're going to have to change some things. If we're going to use the Boys and Girls Club and United Way, I'm going to have to go outside the city. But I don't know what's going to happen. As it evolves, I'll be able to let you know. Because it's going to be a good program once again, and we'll do it next season, not this season. So we got plenty of time to plan it out properly. And I've got a good working relationship with Pirani's Hockey World, which is a local. Actually, it's a local hockey store, but they're nationwide. In fact, international now in Canada and stuff. But they take good care of us by offering the equipment for free. So can't beat that.
How would people get involved in your program?
Well, as it starts to go. Starts to evolve, what I'll have to do is put out requests for those that are interested in participating, you know, because obviously we're going to need folks to just chaperone in the sense of putting the equipment on, and then we'll need those on the ice. But as far as proceeds and those kind of things, it's really so fresh right now as far as trying to reinvent it that I can't tell you where we're going to go with it and how it's going to work, if there's funding already there or if I got to raise some funds. But as the month goes on, in next month, I'll know a lot more whether this is going to happen or not.
Well, Rico, keep in mind, we've talked about this offline, there's good campaigns out there like fundanything.com that you can post what you're doing. It could be anything. A lot of people use Fund Anything for projects like film and TV and whatever production, music production. But there's all sorts of stuff on there. So fundanything.com could be a good resource for you. I know we talked about it, about your fire truck. Tell us about what you do with your truck.
Well, when I was a little kid, I can remember on several occasions we'd be playing pom-pom, as we called it. I think the white kids in the suburbs called it Smear the Queer. I didn't know that until I was quite a bit older. But we was playing football without rules, really.
You can't say up and some... Yeah, you can't say that anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
I've said it a few times and got the double look. Like, yeah, come on. Yeah, we're going to play Smear the Queer. And they're like, what the hell are you talking about?
Right. But we called it pom-pom. I didn't know, you know, I don't even know how that got his name. But it was throw the ball up in the air, somebody catch it and run like hell. Try to get to the other end before you get tapped with the ball taken from you. So just so you know what I'm talking about, I'm not actually talking about doing something violent and illegal. I'm just saying. When we was a kid, we used to play pom-pom. And I remember distinctly one day, I heard a fire truck coming down the road, And for most people, when I say that, they're picturing or in their mind or listening in their mind of a siren coming. And, well, how did he know that? No, there was no siren running. There was a truck coming, and I could tell by the roar of the engine that that was a fire truck. And, of course, I stopped everybody. I said, wait a minute, there's a fire truck coming. And I'm like, we don't hear no fire truck. And then all of a sudden it would come by. They go, man, how the hell did you do that? And I just had this, since I was 6 years old, I wanted to be a firefighter kind of thing. And so when I got into the department, there was this old aerial truck. And an aerial truck is a fire truck with a ladder on it, for those of that are, you know, unfamiliar with it. And it was from 1968, and it was still in our fleet as a backup ladder truck. And I got really involved with our union and started going to parades and stuff like that when we were requested. And I asked our assistant chief at the time if I could take that old aerial to a parade. And the first time I got behind the wheel and roared it down the street, it had that same roar that I'm talking about from when I was a kid, which the more modern fire trucks don't necessarily have. And man, I just fell in love with that truck just because of it, you know. And it was neat. It looks like a fire truck. When you see it, that's a fire truck. You know, there's no question. It don't look like a commercial delivery truck turned into a fire truck. So anyways, a few years went by, and I'd taken the truck out a few more times. And I often told my wife, when that goes to auction, I'm buying it. And she said, yeah, right. So I went to auction, and I happened to see it go down the road. I knew it was going to auction, and I went and bid on it. And without giving the whole long drawn-out story, because it got long and drawn out, I ended up purchasing a 1968 American LaFrance ladder truck, and I would say good condition, for $1,000.
Wow.
Yeah, $1,000. I went and I had to put a new battery in it, so my first day I was already thinking, oh, shit. You know what I mean? Damn, $200 battery? My wife's going, yep, I knew this was going to be a money pit. She's giving me shit. I got to say, oh, I'm sorry. So I go and I put this battery in it, and I pull the switch and push the button, and it started up quicker than my own pickup truck.
Wow.
And it's ran like that pretty much ever since. I've had a few problems with it because it's starting to, you know, wear now. But so what I do with the truck, a lot of people ask, first of all, I've got an original relic of the Flint Fire Department, which it really spawned into a lot of things for me. But one of the coolest things is when I see retirees who actually rode on the truck, and I worked on its last fire, ironically, but a lot of older guys, when they see the truck, they're just blown away that it's still around. And I've taken a few guys on some rides in it, and they're just remembering their glory days. So that turned into taking it to parades, and I'm part of a show. And then, of course, like I told you, I teach fire safety. So once in a while, I've even taken it to schools. And, you know, anybody that has a kid and, you know, that ever dreamed of riding in a fire truck, if I can afford them the opportunity, I let them go for a ride in the fire truck.
Oh, and it blew my son's mind. It blew my son's mind, man. He was just a little tyke.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He talked about it for like years after.
That's cool. That's what it's all about for me, man. Sharing that that dream that I had, and just that feeling that I have when I'm in it. You know, what's really cool is not only taking the kid, but taking their parents with me, because the parents are just as geeked as a kid, because they're like, oh, my God, I'm in a fire truck. Really? Yeah. Can I honk the horn? Can I honk the horn? And so I've been able to share it with a lot of people, and sometimes a little bit too much, because, you know, it's a big beast. It's hard to maintain, and I've got to put some money in it now, and that's how we start talking about, you know, I need to raise some funds, because for the first time ever since I've owned it, should I say, it didn't start and want to run to take it to one of my shows, and I was just heartbroken. And we have a big event here in Flint called Back to the Bricks, and it's becoming something of a phenomenon.
When is Back to the Bricks? When does that go down?
That goes down the third week of August. So this year it's like the August 15th through the 17th, or somewhere in that neighborhood. It goes Tuesday through Friday.
And tell us about Back to the Bricks.
Back to the Bricks is one of the coolest things that's happened to Flint and Genesee County since the heydays of our town. And that's where I started taking my fire truck down there the first year I had it. And that to me was a cool opportunity, because it was in my town. And it started out 50 cars in a car show. And Back to the Bricks got its name based on the fact that our downtown is unique in that all this, the whole main street of our downtown is still in bricks like it was back in the 1800s. They reserved that, or preserved that for many years and refaced it many times. So it's one of the things that's iconic about our town anyways. Probably one of the few things that is still original and still means a lot to our town. So anyways, the guy that put the show together just decided, let's call it Back to the Bricks, because it reminded him of when he was a young guy. He used to go down there in their, you know, cars of the 50s. So this little bitty car show evolved into a conglomerate, Malcolm. It's incredible. There's so many cars and so many people that come to our area for those 4 and 5 days of that week once a year. This will be our 10th year coming up, and I ended up getting on the committee to help make it happen and finding out so much more about the people that helped put this together. I mean, there will literally be 500,000 people in downtown Flint over that period of time.
Well, that's got to be good for tourism. And
oh, man, it's the best thing. Yeah. It comes with its own headaches. You know, if you can imagine, public safety is an issue with that many influx of people. But we're getting people from Canada, all over the state of Michigan, all over the Midwest that are coming to Flint. And it is a gem here for us. And I encourage anybody that wants to, it's not just cars, it's a whole atmosphere. I mean, cars are the coolest thing. There's so many wild, you like, where'd all these classic cars and interesting cars, like my fire truck, I roll it through there and people love it. You know, they think that's the coolest thing. I got a classic fire truck and I drive through the Back to the Bricks. But if you're into cars at all or into that kind of nostalgia, it's the coolest week of the year. And we're lucky to have it right here in Flint.
Well, that's a start. It's probably a good idea for you to keep that fire truck going. I know if you jump on that Fund Anything campaign, that's a great way to, you know, like I said before, to raise awareness and money for what you stand for. Because everything that you stand for, Rico, that you've talked about, is community. You know, being a part of the community, raising awareness, and helping your community, and you're part of that fabric. You're everything that this country was built on. You know, when I see your posts,
whoa, now, now keep putting a lot on my shoulders.
No, listen. My brother and I, we've talked about you a lot, and over the years, and even recently. My brother Trey, he's like, Rico should run for mayor, and but our point is what you believe, you know, you stand up for everything that you say. You know what I mean? What you're saying, you just put right back into, and everything goes into your family and your community. That's what it's about. True or false?
Well, I would have to agree with you totally, Malcolm, that I'm fortunate because I'm living a dream, so to speak. From time to time, I think it's a nightmare. But seriously, I grew up wanting to be a firefighter in my hometown, and that was the gateway or the segue to me understanding what community was all about. You know, I went through some traumatic things when I was in high school with the death of Chad Johnson. I did CPR on a high school peer of mine, and he didn't live. And I thought that was the end of me wanting to help people. But what came of that was this young man's parents and the rest of the baseball team putting their arms around me and saying, you know what, without you, we wouldn't have had any faith. We wouldn't have had any hope. And we thank you for that. You're so important to us. And it sprung my mind open to say, wow, there's a better reason for Rico to be around. Now, I didn't realize it until the year before my oldest son was born, Malcolm. I don't even know if you know this, but I was in a boating accident. And I got tossed out of my boat and almost ran over 2 or 3 times. It's a whole story in itself. But I almost lost my life that day. And when I was able to put my feet down on the shores, and I told myself, there's something more for you to do, Rico. And I didn't really know what it was. But when I started going to the schools and realizing how important that was to those kids that they needed mentors, whether I was in a suburban school or certainly in the inner city schools, that's how I was going to live my life out, kind of giving back. And it makes me feel a lot better about who I am and what I do. You know, I've got my faults. I'm no angel. Man, I got a lot of faults I wish I could be better at. But you know what? No one will ever say Rico didn't live life the way he wanted to the fullest, you know, helping people and just, hey, you know, if I don't make it another day, Rico did what he wanted to do. You know what I mean? So that's how I look at it. You know, I'm a lucky guy to be alive sometimes, I feel.
Yeah, but not being said, Rico, well, just me being from Flint and being a part of everything that went on in Flint in the 80s and early 90s, you stayed there and you continue to thrive there and you continue to help people there. And that says a lot, Rico. I mean, you know, I'm not, you know, trying to put you up on a pedestal or anything like that, but people think highly of you. And in that regard, I think that you will continue to help people and inspire people like that student, that you bumped into, that you turned on to hockey. But I would use those tools, you know, if, you know, I'm really no one to give advice to anyone, but I would definitely use your resources and keep that fire truck going, because I know in this area where I'm at, out in the Washington, D.C. area, if you brought a fire truck to some of these suburbs, man, you would get paid so much money for birthday parties, and, you know, just events with children and stuff like that. I mean, you know, with Back to the Bricks and stuff, I would use that as a platform to promote your hockey league. And, you know, I think to me, it feels like you're doing the right thing. We just need to get more people involved. And I think that with budget cuts and everything that's going on with the local government in Flint, because a lot of people, they're looking, you know, they're looking on their TV, their big 60-inch television sets in the suburbs and shaking their heads, but they're not acting.
Well, absolutely. I agree with you there, big time. It's amazing that the blame game is pretty much the norm in our country right now. We can blame everybody else for what's not right, but nobody's willing to stand up and try to make even the smallest changes. I shouldn't say nobody. There's lots of people that do, but there's so many more people that could just do something small to help out community. Everybody look back at community, not just themselves. Maybe we can be starting to head in the right direction where we don't have school shootings every other week. I mean, that's crazy, Malcolm. School shooting. I mean, unfortunately, Flint is the first well-known school shooting in our country. I mean, I should have brought all that up because it's more negatively on Flint, because there's a lot of positive things going on here too. But I mean, that was like the dawn of what we didn't realize was going to be almost the norm, where we have to worry about sending our kids to school. Yeah. And it goes back to this whole lack of community thing.
Yeah, when you have lack of community and you take away, elements of that fabric, it just starts to break down. And people, a lot of anger starts to transition. And through that anger, you have violence. It's basic math.
Right.
What we have to do is pay attention, and then you have to act. You have to be a person of action. In your case, you're a man of action, and you're stepping up. But you're only one man, and hopefully that you inspire someone else, like a neighbor or a student or a parent, and then they become a person of action. And that's how you start to rebuild the community. And I believe that. Places like Flint and Detroit will rebuild. But what really burns me up is when I see a lot of celebrities and I see a lot of charities, and they're putting a lot of focus on overseas interests. And I understand it looks good and it probably makes people feel good to do so. But I've said this once, and I'll continue to be an advocate for it. I'm a big fan of taking care of homegrown issues, you know what I mean?
I'm with you.
I'm a big fan of that, just because, you know, I'm a product of it, and I could have went the other way just as fast, you know what I mean? There was a time when I don't want to blame it on Flint, but there was a time, you know, when I use the term, when Flint started to erode me, some of my issues and some of the distractions that I allowed to penetrate my circle. And I started making, you know, wrong choices. Fortunately for me, I had that foundation, and I had a family structure that allowed me options to relocate or to, clear my head and find a different place. And that's what I did when I left Flint in the early 90s. But a lot of people don't have that option. They don't have that family structure or support. and they don't have those opportunities to just get up and leave or have someone provide them with a job or put them through school or, you know, let them know about a hockey league that exists that's willing to pay attention to them. So,
right.
You know, little stuff that you're doing is inspiring. I just got a text from my brother Trey, and he reiterated, tell Rico to run for mayor.
I don't think that's going to happen. I'm trying to keep all my friends, Mal.
Yeah, yeah.
Politics, my real friends.
Politics, it gets a little dirty. So,
I think I'm in the right spot. I'm happy. I had to learn how to kind of cut back a little bit too, because I do have a family, and also there's people around you that don't have, sometimes, unfortunately, there's people around you that just suck off of you or they look at you with envy. I was fortunate enough that as a vice president of our union who was in charge of public relations, I got extremely popular here in Flint, and I could have never done that if I went to any other fire department in the country, I don't think. So that had so many people around me that I didn't realize were looking to kick me off the pedestal, so to speak. So I had to learn how to temper back and say, okay, what's going to help me feel the best as if I'm going to put myself out there. And so that's why I switched up what I was doing a little bit and went more to the sport I love, which is hockey. And this time when we're trying to put the inner city program together, the people were contacting me about it. It wasn't me having to reach out to people. And so it made me feel a lot better as far as like the future is where I want it to be. Like you said, more people helping, more people trying to reach out and figure out ways to do something for, if it's just some kid who really never had a chance to do nothing different in his life. If he just watches one more game that he never would have watched of this crazy ass sport called hockey or whatever it is, just meet new interesting people as far as I'm concerned. You know what I mean? So I think it's all been good though, Malcolm. I mean, you know, as I look back and I look at our town and where it's gone through and what it's been through, I look at Flint as a place that's got an opportunity to rebuild itself. It's just, my fear is it's going to take as long as or longer to rebuild it as it did to tear it down. And that's the God's honest truth. I mean, there's 10,000 vacant buildings, structures in our town. You wonder why we're the capital of arson. I mean, there's so many things to burn. There's so many neighborhoods to burn up. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, I mean, you can't convince a corporation that's getting tax breaks over, you know, by moving their facilities overseas to move back into Flint. I mean, if you take a major manufacturing company like GM or Buick or Ford, and you take these companies out, I mean, to fill those 10,000 properties, I mean, it would, God knows what it would take. I mean, right now, when I go back to Flint, I see a lot of restaurants. I see the college side of things. But it won't. It would be difficult for it to be a boom town again, Flint and Detroit, unless a company like, you know, some major corporation like Samsung or an Apple or something decides to start manufacturing their smartphones or something like that here and set up. But I mean, what are those chances? Like, you know,
right? I mean, if they're not here right now, like I say, it's going to have to. I think what's still is apparent here is that there's still a high level of crime, although the crime has gone down last year. That's what they're reporting, so that's a good thing. That once they get a hold of the crime, which is incredibly difficult to do, again, with all the vacant property and lack of jobs. I mean, those two factors make it very difficult to keep crime down. But once they get a hold on that, then maybe, you know, and they're going to have to sustain it for a long time. I mean, not this past year. We had a good year again, like I said, but the year before we had record murder homicides in our little town. And so you can't just have one good year and think, like you said, an apple's going to come to a Flint, Michigan. Although Flint has some great things about it. I mean, where it's located in our state, it's adjacent to Canada. It's got a pipeline going both ways to Canada to shipping from both, you know, so it's a great place.
Well,
but
one of the things that I like about what's been going on, well, I've been keeping an eye on it, and I'm noticing that there are a lot of television and film companies going to Detroit to do filming. I don't know if that will go into Flint or not, but I'm noticing a lot of production companies are starting to film. I don't know if that's just because Detroit's so run down and it has the look of, that they're looking for. But if I, you know, I would really like to see some studios, you know, set up a shop there, just because you do have all that property that they could probably buy cheap.
Yep.
And set up a, you know, quote unquote, you know, mini Hollywood there, and where you could build studios for, you know, for filming. You know, it's a kind of a fantasy that I think like that. But what else would you use all that land where they basically ripped everything that they could out of GM, picked up everything and moved it, and you have nothing but, you know, hundreds of yards of open space.
And that's, you know, the way it is here, big time. Just a couple places are like that.
Yeah, just open space. I mean, it's heartbreaking to see that. But the people are still standing, and there's people like yourself that's, like I said, that's, you know, inspiring. And you know, when you look back from the late 70s and 80s, especially with, in the 80s, when crack cocaine and the flood of drugs just hit the communities, it just ravaged the place. And the fact that your families are still standing, from GM to drugs and you know, violence, it says a lot. The strength of Americans, like real true life Americans that are persistent and have the strength and the ability to overcome these obstacles.
Well, I'd like to believe that rap music is why I'm so successful today.
Hey, man, all jokes aside, there's two reasons why I didn't do drugs in high school, right? And they were there. There was a lot of stuff being passed around.
Oh, yeah.
One, Run DMC.
Yeah.
Two, I was just fearful that my old man would kill me. So those two reasons. But yeah, hip-hop, Run DMC, rap music, I believed all along. I found out that Run DMC was getting high the whole time, but
yeah, yeah. They tried to act like they were. They're drinking 40s.
Ain't that a bitch? Well, the 40s, yeah. I partaked in a 40 here and
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I hear you.
I saw a girl at the store yesterday buying some 40s.
Damn.
I looked at her. Yeah, a little girl from the suburbs, blonde hair, blue-eyed. She had two big 40s. I was like, what's this cat getting into?
I'm here.
And it brought me back for a minute, because you couldn't pay me, Rico Phillips, to drink a 40-ounce.
Oh, I know it, man. No.
But yeah, drugs, rap, music, it definitely kept me occupied.
Right.
I remember my grandmother used to always call me the music man, because every Friday, you know, my grandfather would, like, give me an allowance, and I'd go to what was the name of that record store on Dort Highway? I think it was Nick's.
Nick's Records and Tapes.
Yeah, yeah, Nick's Records. And it always smelled like incense. You'd walk up in there. Fine Arab lady that worked there, man. And she would look at me, man. She was a cougar before cougars were cougars. You know
right.
what I mean? And I'd buy two records every week.
Yeah.
And I would. That's how I started my collection. And Nick's.
I remember going there with you on a number of occasions. I went to Nick's on the north side too. That's when you really get the underground.
Yeah.
To get up, you know, you had to go up there. Before there, I don't know if you ever, like I was saying about buying Rapper's Delight, there was a place downtown Flint, which is certainly not there anymore. It was called Capitol Records. We used to have to go down in the basement of this record store to get your records across from Capitol Theater. I don't know if you remember that.
Hell yeah. The Fat Boys was at the Capitol Theater.
Yeah, they were. That's right.
Fat Boys. And Run DMC came to, what was the skating rink? I think it was on the North, Rolettes or something.
Rolettes. I seen them there too. Yeah. Yep. And oh, then, my gosh.
Do you remember the old rap group? I think it was Took and Bone. Took BMC. You don't remember them, do you?
No, I don't remember them. Man. I'll be honest.
Yeah. There was MCs, it was a magical time, even with all the obstacles that we had to go through at that time. And just as children, you know what I mean? 16 years old, just children, just being exposed to the early days of rap, hip hop, the Beastie Boys, and just
oh my gosh, I
went out of my mind. I remember going out of my mind trying to find a bottle of Brass Monkey.
I know, I did too. And then I tasted it. I was pissed off. It tasted so bad. I was like, man, this don't taste good, man.
Yeah, I think me and Amato, we drunk it all in his basement. I think I threw up in a hat or something.
Damn. Man, those were the days, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. I went to... I seen Public Enemy last summer, and the whole entourage that they had. They had LL Cool J was there, Ice Cube, De La Soul, and man, I mean, it was real. I knew more than once. I teared up, man. I was at the Pine Knob, which now they call DTE, and I remember going there with you guys. I don't remember exactly which crew because we went to every concert. So, but I was standing next to my sons. And they were trying to get into it, you know what I mean? And I was just like...
You're reminiscing.
I was reminiscing. I was in shock, man. No, it's one thing we talked about, how rap was along racial lines back then, believe it or not. But the difference from a concert 25 years down the road was there were so many white people at this concert. I said, man, they would have never been here 25 years ago. They were scared.
Yeah.
Now they're here. It was funny. It was cool, though. Don't get me wrong. It was really cool to see everybody vibing together. There was no anger in the air at all, man.
There's not a moment that doesn't go by when I see brothers and sisters from all walks of life, especially here in the Washington, D.C. area. I see Asians. I see all walks of life. And I see them with their hat, with their shoes and everything. And when I see hip-hop thriving like that, I'm happy, man. I'm overjoyed because, yes, I remember that time when it was frowned upon. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
I was booed. Like, I would do house parties. I remember taking my two turntables over the summer, left Flint, Michigan, came here to the Washington, D.C. area and would spin little parties and would be booed because certain areas just didn't know what rap music was.
Wow.
They were just like, what the hell are you playing? And they just they couldn't get it in, like, 89. And it wasn't until, I think it wasn't until, like, PE and then NWA in the late were very, very early 90s. And with the rise of NWA is when it started to cross over. That's when a lot of the kids from the suburbs were starting to emulate and imitate, you know, what they were seeing. And then, you know, once the rich kids get a hold of it and there's money, when it starts to be accepted in the quote unquote mainstream, which is fine, you know, but hip hop. From the 90s on, it just, to me anyway, rap music kind of, its growth, it's stunted. It just kind of remained the same between, you know, pimping and gangsterism and all that. And you know, it was the rise of gangsters and then the demise of the philosophy side of it, the awareness of hip hop. And just before, you know, you had so many diverse acts, and now pretty much everyone is a carbon copy of a carbon copy of a carbon
copy. Right. It is real, Malcolm. I agree with you totally. I mean, you know who I was telling my son yesterday, because I got on the XM radio, got Backspin. So obviously I'm listening to old school all the time. And as well as right next to it, I got the new stuff. So obviously I'm trying to keep up with the kids, but also I like good beats and hooks, you know. I don't like all the lyrics. The lyrics are, like you said, pretty stupid anymore. Garbage.
They would have been booed back in the day.
Booed. It would have crushed the movement.
The real MCs, Rico Phillips, the real MCs would have put a stop to that noise with a lot of the MCs have going on today. They wouldn't even been classified as MCs.
Right.
They wouldn't have made it. The only thing that's keeping them alive today, two things, money and technology. Their beats, their music is so tight. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they got it.
Yeah, they people give it a pass. They get the radio play. So as you were saying about XM?
Well, you know, so I was listening and I thought to myself, I was listening to MC Hammer. I mean, I wasn't listening to it. It was on. I changed it real quick. And
you
I
were
said,
listening
you know
to
what?
It.
MC Hammer. Yeah, I had to make sure that was clear, Mal. But I said, as much as I despise MC Hammer, that guy was almost instrumental in crossing it over completely.
He was game changing in the fact that he wasn't scared to scream on the mic.
Right.
And B, he wasn't, you know, he was as flamboyant, but he kind of brought that whole element of dancing and entertaining into rap music, where, you know, it's just like we used to do. Don't crack a smile. You got your B-boy stance, you know what I mean?
Right.
You hold it, you hold it, you know, and you own it. But he kind of brought, it's okay, be an entertainer, you know, wear parachute pants and you know what I mean? Do it.
And just keep doing it.
Hammer don't hurt him.
Right.
You know?
I don't want to be remiss, man. We had some good artists in the 80s, like, you know, Prince. I mean,
yeah.
Guys like him.
Oh, yeah. My brother, you know, they had a whole crew.
You
got to
talk about it with your brother.
You know what I mean? He had a whole crew of Prince, him and Pierce and all those dudes, man. They were all, you know, soft. They were soft and hard because they would go to school. Like, my brother and his crew would go to school and they would dress up in suits.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then in the streets, they dress up like ninjas.
Holy mackerel, man.
Do you remember hood ninjas?
Yeah, I do remember, man. They used to be on the Kung Fu movement going on,
man.
Too, man.
Do you remember them dudes, Trey and Fred, and them dudes would wear Chinese outfits?
Right.
With the Chinese slippers?
I thought they was... Bruce Lee. I remember I tried for a minute, hit myself with one of them sticks. I said, "That's all right, man.
Kung Fu and hip hop is the perfect marriage. Always has been. Always will be.
Right.
I just ninjas in the hood has always blown my mind. I'm telling you, Rico. And with hip hop and the diverse acts, but now people. One of the things that I see, and maybe you can weigh in on this, Rico. What's up with the amount of biting that goes on today? Like, people aren't scared to recite someone else's lyrics. I was online, I swear to God, to you, and I emailed them as soon as I saw it. There is a DJ in the Washington, D.C. area, and his name is Rev Run, and he wears an Adidas sweatsuit. How is that possible?
Wow, man. He should be just put in exile, man. He should be put in exile. I don't understand. I mean,
even if he's a fan, how is that possible? I'm assuming that he is a fan, but how is that possible that an MC or a DJ can, and, you know, I'm not even going to get into the conversation because we'll be on here another hour about what they call DJing these days, but the disc jockey, but I'm going to leave it as that. The dude had an Adidas sweatsuit on and called himself Rev Run. I took the picture, blew it up, looked at it, analyzed it. It bothered me. It was like 1 in the morning. I was up to like 2 a.m. looking at this picture, and I was like, this is really bothering me. I emailed Run and was like, really? This is today. This is hip-hop today.
Man, I can't believe that. That's like blasphemy.
People get a pass because they're getting paper. I mean, you take Rick Ross now. Rick Ross is famous. He's blown up. He's down with Jay-Z, and the cat pretty much stole his identity from Freeway Ricky Ross, a real life dude that's fighting today in courts over the fact that his identity has been stolen, and everyone gives him a pass.
You know? Man, I'm going to tell you right now, something is I don't know if it's an industry, if it's a mindset. I mean, obviously, we're in the me era of generations. There's no question about that. When you look at probably even your own son, you can see it in him, how they're just programmed differently. As much as I try to teach my kids that it's a bigger picture than that, it's still all about them personally, whatever's going on in their world. And so all I'm thinking is people aren't even worried about respect and the other things that go along with being a good person in life. They're just worried about me right now.
So
if I get paper biting, I'm biting. I don't care.
That's right, Rico. And with that, but see, with that mindset again is the killer of the community, because if people are just all about themselves, they buy a house, they live in a house for 2 or 3 years, then they leave. They don't care about the community at large. They don't care if they're looking at television and they see, Flint, Michigan or Youngstown, Ohio, or they see, any place in the United States of America, because it's not about them. It's not affecting them at this point in time. So not worried about it. It's not affecting their paper. So that type of mindset is the thing that's going to be our undoing. So it's up to individuals like ourselves to say, hey, man, this ain't right. You can't be Rev Run. You know what I mean?
Right.
You can't be, you know, Rick Ross. You can't dismiss Flint, Michigan. We do exist. We are here. And we're going to do something about it, and we're going to get more people involved to pay attention to us and not keep, you know, taking away budget, having budget cuts so we don't have firefighters, so we don't have police officers, so we can have more events like Back to the Bricks, because we do bring something to the table. True or false, Rico Phillips?
Oh, absolutely true. And here's the thing, as we look forward, you know, and you look at a place like a Flint, there's many Flints out there. It's just, it's all relative as to who and where they're at. But what's important is you know, like with the, we talked about computers a little bit. I think we've almost outsmarted ourselves, Malk. I mean, so much is at our hands that it seems so distant sometimes, but yet it's so close. I don't know if that makes sense, if I'm making sense. But what I'm saying is that you can look at Youngstown, Ohio and say, yep, that's Youngstown, Ohio, and not even look at in your own backyard at what's happening here where you're at, because you're all about me. How we change all that, I'm not sure. But one thing we can do is they're doing some good things here in the Flint. They, for the first time in 50 years, they have a plan, a city plan put together. Well, as a result of completing that, and it took a lot of work from a lot of different people, certainly from our business community, some of our other political leaders, but it took a big, and then the member or the community at large got together, and they put together a plan for the future of Flint. And it's kind of like eye-opening, like, how the hell did we do this for 50 years without some kind of something we're working off of here? So anyways, as a result of that, the federal government is going to send in some specialists in the area of urban development and redevelopment. And so you never know, the beginnings of things might be happening in a place like Flint. And it's taken not necessarily the politicians, it's taken raw dog people that decide to stand up for what they believe in, and that's Flint, Michigan. The business community has said, I'm not going to be run off because, you know, there's nothing left here but poor niggas up in the North End.
Yeah.
They're taking a look at the whole situation and saying, you know what, we can have a better Flint. This is where I was born and raised. This is how we're going to do this. And so what I'm hoping for is that we actually, instead of being the model for what's bad in our society, as far as other people can tell from the outside, and hopefully we become a model for how you pull your bootstraps up and say, let's do it, man. Let's stop talking about it. I'd like to see it in my lifetime. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't know if I can hang that long. I'm ready to move the hell out myself, and not because I'm ready to move out of Flint. I'm telling you right now, Malcolm, here's a hard thing for a person from a place like here that certainly does the type of work I do, is when I go to other communities, like I've gone to Traverse City and I've drove down this one particular road, and as I'm coming over the top of the road, I look out and I see Grand Traverse Bay and the beauty of our state and our world around us, and I think about what I see when I'm on my way to work. I get pissed on my way to work when I see how many vacant houses I'm looking at, and buildings.
Yeah,
I want to look at some beauty in my life before I die, too. Every time I come out the door, I want to be able to look at something beautiful, man. So I don't know. You know, that's the hard part for a person like me from Flint, who really I can do a lot, but I don't know how much longer. That's the hard part.
Well, the thing is, Rico, whether you know it or not, or whether you realize it or not, is you're helping create that beauty. You know, you may or may not see it, but everything that you're doing is starting to create that beauty because you're taking action. It takes more than one person. We agree on that. And maybe someone will hear this podcast and be inspired, or maybe you'll run into someone in the near future and be inspired. But that's the chain reaction. And with our advancements in technology, I do encourage you to use it. Use social media. Use these tools that we have to connect with people, because, again, it's easy for people to turn the channel, flip through the channels, go on the internet, someplace like Yahoo or some website, some social media giant, and they put out a list saying worst places to live, and Flint's in there. Well, I think as if they have the money to produce a list like that, I think they have the money to put in that community, into those communities. You know what I mean? You have Youngstown, you have Benton Harbor, Michigan, you have Flint, Michigan, you have Detroit. It was so easy to point that finger and say, ah, look at this shithole. But no, we have to care about what we're doing here. And that's where it starts.
I agree. And I just hope that, like you said, someone listens or, you know, whatever. You know, it's always good to talk about these things openly and discuss it. So it kind of like, you know, pump some more life into you and say, hey, you know what? As bad as things could be, they could be worse. And so let's smile and move forward and keep giving back. And even if it's just to discuss it, it's a form of giving back so that there's awareness out there. So I'm hoping for the best.
Well, Rico, you're a man of action, and we appreciate everything that you're doing. Even I'm as far removed as I am out of Flint, Michigan. My heart is still there, and you know, I appreciate you being on the show today.
Oh yeah, no problem. It was an honor. I got to tell you, I was almost a little nerved up only because, man, it was just so much that we could discuss and I know that we had a great friendship back in the 80s when we were hanging out and just to reminisce about it all. You know, I still, obviously my parents still live in the same neighborhood that we grew up in, and I still see your cousin Fred from time to time, and Gene, and often I go back into those times. Of course, if I go in my mom's house, all the decor is still from the 70s, so I can't escape it too far. Anyways, when I go there, it reminds me of being a kid. But we had some great times, and it made us, like we said earlier, it made us who we are today. And so those friends that and family that you have that that probably wonder what it was like to grow up in Flint, you got to realize that you're a great person because of your experience there. And look at how much you're able to share with other people, man. You're living your own dream. So I'm proud of you, man. I really am.
Thank you. Thank you. And we can pick up this podcast. We can do another one. We'll talk about other elements. Because I could ramble on long. I can get long winded and do a 3-4 hour podcast. That's easy to do, but we definitely want people to know what's going on, you know, what we went through and what's what other people are going through right now in the community and other communities like that. There's a lot of really cool stories. I'm trying to come back up there for a quick trip. I don't know if I'm going to be up. I've got something I'm looking at this month. I've got an event in Detroit, and I've also kind of re-energized myself in completing a film I've been working on for the better part of 12 years around Flint, and I think I finally figured it out. But we'll talk more about that, you know, in the coming months.
All right.
But yeah, you're a man of action. Keep it up. You've inspired me, and you've got me listening, and I'm always watching. And Rico Phillips, thanks for joining American Riddle.
Hey, it was my pleasure. I look forward to the next time for sure.
All right. And thank you guys for tuning in. This is your boy, Malcolm Riddle, Domino Motherfucker.
They seen your face on an 8-track, getting it good to the wood. So the people give you some of that reacting to the facts that I kick in a stick, in a stay around, point to the joint, put the booty down. Going, get to the roots, and giving it up, so turn it loose. Then again, I got a story that's harder than a hardcore course of the Holocaust. I'm talking about the ones still going on. I know where from that dumb.
Just watch your step. Can't trust it.
No.
Because of that, now I get my teeth. So here's a song to the strong.